Almost no population. It's going to be just buzzwords, just the hype. Why are people so interested in the microwave background? Basically, cartoon pictures of the physics, but not really any calculation. I'm going to leave that for the second lecture. The second lecture is going to be some painful calculations to do. It will be a very pleasant lecture to follow, but anyway, you need to have some grounding on what kind of tools, what kind of techniques are used. It's not very highbrow, very highbrow mathematics. It's basically Boltzmann equation, solving the Boltzmann equation. But I'll tell you how that's done, and then the kind of mathematical tools required. And then in the third lecture, we will talk about the forefront of the field, which is polarization. So far, people have looked into temperature and isotropies. And the big thing coming up is the polarization. Is the microwave background polarized, and what does it mean? Let me just tell you the answer. Basically, we could detect gravity waves using this tool, this important tool, which is a major thing. So I'll see what level, basically, I will do that later on. And maybe I'll go back to the cartoon level to discuss polarization. But anyway, let me start then just by the temperature. I won't talk much about polarization in this lecture. What I will do is go into the temperature in a very physical way and tell you what the issues are, what's been going on in the field. So the basic picture is this one. You have like a space-time diagram in a very loose sense. And if you do things in such a way that the light propagates at 45 degrees, forget about expansion, this is all at the moment very, very kind of sketchy. One thing people don't know very much, or forget sometimes, that the sky, what you call the sky when you look up, is actually a cone in four dimensions. So it's a series of shells, we hear, this is us. And what you call the sky is essentially a series of shells that go further and further into the distance, but go into the past as well. And this is archaeology for cosmologists. It's a way to probe the past, just looking through the distance. So what you do is, you basically keep looking further and further away, and eventually, because there is a Big Bang, let's forget about inflation and all that stuff for the time being, there's a thing called the horizon. And again, I won't be very technical about what horizons mean, but there is a distance beyond which you can't see because there was nothing to see before that, using this thing that looking further means looking into the past. So this is a very important picture, but one thing which is crucial here is that there is a point here, a very important time, in which there's a transition. The universe was opaque before, by which I mean optically opaque, so things like neutrinos and so on could be a different story. And then the universe becomes transparent optically. And what you're talking about is trying to probe the universe via the optical, which is what the astronomers do. And at some point, there is a transition between what you can't see and what you can see. So the universe is transparent after this point, it's opaque beyond this point. So the kind of universe as it appears to us looks like a cavity, some kind of big cavity, which is a few billion light years across, so it's a very big cavity. And at some point, essentially, even before you hit the horizon, you hit the opaque. So the microwave background is exactly this. The microwave background is essentially the first glow of light in a transparent phase. And it's essentially as far back into the past or as far into the distance as you can go if you confine yourself to the optical. So of course, gravity waves would be great if you could detect it directly, if you could actually make a telescope which used as the information conveyor gravity waves, it'd be good because the universe probably is transparent all the way up to the Planck time. So essentially, what you call this surface in which the microwave background is emitted would actually be the Planck epoch if you had any kind of way of making experiments with gravity waves. But this thing you call the last scattering surface. It's a very important point. The last scattering surface is exactly your limitation as far as observational cosmology is concerned. So what you see is obviously you're going to see galaxies and other things which are and quite common around you initially. You keep looking further and further. Then you hit a point here in which you see a lot of weird things, astrophysically, quasars, etc. So the universe changes a bit in quality as you go beyond. Then there's a thing called the Dark Ages, okay, in which basically all these astrophysical things, they have not gone sufficiently nonlinear to start emitting light and you can't see very much. And then there is a microwave vacuum. And you might as well get the big question here. At some point, the universe reionizes. So the things becoming, I'll mention this in a bit more detail, but things becoming reionized normally, so the universe going plasma-like again, means essentially things starting to shine again, means light, means essentially being able to see, okay? So this is the big picture. So let me just now give you some qualitative details about what happens. What is this crazy transition that brings you from opaque to transparent? It's atomic physics. There's nothing really neat about this, but it's very important. So feel free to ask any questions, by the way. It's going to become progressively more and more complicated as we go along. Just interrupt any time. Okay, so there's a cartoon. Now let me tell you the cartoon of the physics. So this is not so much this picture now, but it's exactly what is going on in this transition. So there's really three steps which lead to this transition between opaque and transparent. And maybe I will do the calculation properly later on, but let me give you the physics, first of all. So the step number one is called recombination. And what this means is, I don't know why this is called recombination, there's nothing, well, things were not combined in the first place, I don't know why they recombined, but it's one of these crazy terminology things. But basically what we're talking about is electrons and protons becoming hydrogen. So it's this process by which a photon can ionize an hydrogen atom to produce an ion and an electron, or vice versa. You actually can get the electron to form an atom, emitting a photon. So as you know, the ionization energy of hydrogen is 13.6 electron volts, something like this. So immediately this could give you an idea of what is going on, what's going to happen. When it becomes energetically more favorable to produce neutral hydrogen, you will do so. So the tool here is just basically statistical physics, but not in non-equilibrium, it's equilibrium, statistical physics. You know how to compute the abundances of all these things. It only depends on their energy, but there's a Boltzmann factor, which basically determines everything. And what happens is that at some point, the universe becomes neutral. Now, there's a subtlety here that you might as well learn about it straight away. And the subtlety is that there's a lot more photons than there are baryons. It's a mystery in the universe. We don't actually know why. There's a number which is essentially eta, which is essentially the number of photons over the number of baryons, i.e. protons or hydrogens, whatever. And this thing is ridiculously big. So the universe has a lot of entropy, and we don't know exactly why. It's called the baryogenesis problem. This number is very big, it's something like 10 to the 8, 10 to the 10. And this is a conserved quantity. So unless you invoke grand unified theories in which you can violate the baryon number or whatever, unless you produce entropy, in which you change the number of photons, this number stays constant. So when I say there is a statistical physics problem here, which is just equilibrium statistical physics, there's a subtlety. It's basically the usual equilibrium properties, but with a constraint. The constraint being that this number is fixed. And this is what sometimes leads to the Sahar equation. I'm not going to write it, but you know, I'm just going to tell you the physics. Basically, a combination of the equilibrium abundances, but with this constraint, that's what you get. And because this number is so big, because there are so many more photons than there are baryons, you actually need to drop the temperature significantly, much below 13.6 electron volts, for the universe to become neutral. So this is one subtlety. I didn't do any calculation, but I told you about this subtlety. And what you find is that the universe only becomes reasonably neutral at the temperature of the order of 4,000 Kelvin, which goes is basically 1 eV. There's essentially an order of magnitude in the naive expectation than what you actually get, because we have so many more photons than protons. Okay, so this is point number one. It's this is not exactly what causes the universe to go transparent, but it sets the stage for it. And so the next point is exactly next stage, what we call decoupling, or sometimes we call this last scattering. I called it already, I think. And this is essentially something that results from there. The universe, why is the universe opaque? Well, it's a plasma. Plasma consists of a plasma, essentially because of this interaction. So the photons interact with free electrons, and sometimes called Compton scattering or Compton scattering, and this is the reason why you can't see anything in a plasma. So this is the reason why the universe becomes opaque at some point. It's ionized, there's a lot of electrons, it's a plasma. And as a result, the photons interact with these electrons. There's a cross-section for these, and you can compute that, and essentially the universe is opaque for this reason. So I don't know much cosmology, you know, but whereas over there that requires what you call the expanding universe combined with equilibrium distributions, here what you require is essentially going out of equilibrium and expanding universe. And this is a normal calculation we do with neutrinos, with anything else. If you have any kind of interaction like this one, what you need to compute is the rate of interaction gamma, and you need to compare these with the rate of expansion of the universe. And essentially, you say that one interaction is fermal, is fermalized, and you can use the equilibrium distributions, if the number of interactions is such that you actually can adjust the temperature of the universe depending, which is on the rate of h. So if this gamma is much bigger than h, you can have fermal equilibrium. If it's not, you basically fall out of equilibrium. So the definition of transparent is actually this one. I will be more rigorous later on, but basically, as soon as this interaction, Compton scattering, becomes more rare than the expansion rate of the universe, then you say that the universe has become transparent. And why does this happen? This happens because the electrons plunge inside, they form hydrogen atoms. So you take away the targets, and as a result, you take away the ability of the photons to interact with the electrons, and the universe becomes transparent. So the reason why this happens is basically target electrons are removed. And this is done by one. So this is done by the step number one. So this is exactly this point. It's this big transition and the universe finally is transparent. Let me tell you what this means, again, in a cartoon kind of picture. So if you have something called visibility, which I will define in terms of this cross-section and so on. And if you have time, what actually happens is that there's some kind of curve like this. And if you actually plug all the numbers in, at around 370 kiloyears, the universe becomes suddenly transparent. The width is actually quite big. We're talking about 100 kiloyears big. So you're talking on the order of thousands of years, which is the point when the universe becomes transparent. If you want to see how narrow, how thin that veneer is in that picture, basically, you're talking about 14 gigayears or 13 gigayears until nowadays. So it's not exactly the Big Bang. And as I said, if you really want to do something that would prove quantum gravity, you'd better have something like gravity waves instead of optical. But it's a fair way back in the past. You're really going all the way to basically 6 orders of magnitude into the beginning of the universe. And this is the kind of picture you should have. This is nowadays giga year. This is kilo year. Okay, let me give you step number three. And I said there's three steps here. So the step number three is the thing which is kind of a big puzzle in astrophysics. But it's essentially, well, let me drill. First of all, the thing called freeze out. So the freeze out means things going out of equilibrium. In this case, it means this interaction going out of equilibrium. So the universe keeps going down, down, down in temperature. You know, as soon as you go beyond this one electron volt, more and more neutral hydrogen is produced. And basically, if the thing was in equilibrium all the way through, you'd get this ionization into zero. The universe would be exactly neutral. But at some point, there's a cross-section here as well. We have to compare that cross-section with the expansion of the universe. And the same way that you fall out of equilibrium for the quantum scattering, you will fall out of equilibrium for that interaction. So when that happens, you leave a residual ionization. When that interaction, when that interaction is relative. So when these things decouple, and you can compute exactly what it is in the same way you could compute with quantum scattering, when that happens, you end up with some residual ionization. You can compute it, it's basically very small, it's something like 10 to the minus 5. And why am I telling you this? Because this is a big mystery. If you look around the universe nowadays, it's completely ionized. So this happens, but nowadays, the universe is ionized. So this is a very strange thing. Actually, if you compute, for example, things like electric conductivity of the universe, the universe is one of the best conductors you can think of. It's totally ionized, and somehow this happened, and didn't happen for the reasons I've told you. So what this means is that during this dark ages period, something injected energy into the universe, high energy photons, some kind of things that started to shine very early on and reionize the universe. And here's a big question mark. What is the right reionization process? When did it happen? If the universe reionizes very early on though, what happens is it creates a second mass scattering surface. So that picture is not completely correct. There will be an initial mass scattering surface, and then there'll be some crazy reionization process that basically bumps into the photons again. And what we've seen when you look at the microwave background is not exactly the mass scattering surface we thought, and when I mentioned there, level of kiloliters, but something more recent. But if you do the calculation properly, you can find that if the redshift of reionization is smaller than 43, so I recall this thing here is just basically the expansion factor nowadays divided by the expansion factor at reionization. If this thing is smaller than 43, what you can prove is that the density of electrons has gone down sufficiently that even though we have lots of photons again, they won't scatter again. So if this happens, there's no rescattering of photons. And this is in a very, very qualitative way of the picture. Essentially, what we don't know yet is whether the universe reionized or not. Later on, I'll tell you about some excitement that occurred a few years ago. People thought they had found evidence for reionization. It doesn't look like that's the case. And basically, if the reionization occurred sufficiently late, it doesn't really matter for the microwave background. If it occurred early enough, then it does. And we leave an imprint which is very clear, as I'll be telling you about. Okay, any questions about this? This is really like step number one. So, if you have any questions, this is a good point to ask.
Did all three of these steps have different times, or is it like in the first two steps were at the same time?
No, this is a different time. So I'm, yeah, maybe I should have thought.
You said that because the electrons are moved, that's why the reaction rate for the quantum scattering drops. Mm-hmm. They're moved because it's step one, so what do you know immediately?
Yes, it's basic. It takes essentially, you see the problem with this calculation. You have to put the numbers in, do it numerically, and then it comes out. So I forgot to say, this is about 3,000 degrees temperature. That's about 4,000 degrees. And this is much greater. So this is really in chronological order. So when you say that, so the microwave background now is about 2.7 Kelvin, when the redshift was around 1,000, when the temperature was about 3,000 degrees, then you have this last step. We need weak, of course.
But if the electrons all combined in the hydrogen at 4,000 Kelvin, then why did it take all the way until 3,000 before the constant standard?
Because it's a gradual process. So then 4,000 is more or less. I mean, the thing basically takes time. It's important that it's not 13.6 electron volt that's the crucial step. It's actually one electron volt, because there's so many volts. But then, you know, it's basically an exponential. It's this Boltzmann factor. So there's a width, of course. I mean, things start being exponentially surprised, but with the width. And that width provides basically the leverage. Then you have to put the actual quantum cross section there to see how many electrons should I take away before this can be happened. And it's not a simple calculation. You need to know the numbers, and you need to actually get the figures with numerically to actually get these numbers and tell it. But it's a 1-2-3 process in which, yeah, I mean, it's not different, they're both, but it's not exactly at the same time.
And where is the last process on a large scale structure?
These results from the large scale structure. So the last, you mean the reionization or the? Oh, I see. No, I mean, I don't think it would. I mean, it does on very, very small scales. So you're talking about, for example, every time you have a supernova, you blow up things, you have these, you know, yeah, this is on really small scales. So there's one point, there's a very crucial scale called the Jeans length, which tells you where gravity becomes stronger than pressure, for example. Or if you compute the Jeans length compared to the scale, at which these things happen, it's much, it's really, really much larger. So basically, things which are really, really very small scales will be affected, but only those.
So are you saying that in the large scales, the universe is neutral?
No, it's neutral on all scales. I'm just saying that this, for example, these processes, which should be essentially electromagnetic processes, are not strong enough against gravity. So things like clumping of matter and all that.
Won't I'm just worried about that. Is it not based on Copernicus
universe? Say it again, please.
Nowadays,
yeah, but that's, so this is what, so one thing is the effect on ionization or neutrality on large-scale structure. And I just said it's very small. The other thing is the opposite. What caused the universe to reionize? And that is exactly the formation of what we call the large-scale structure of the universe. As far as we know, so there's one quantity, which is delta rho over rho. And this depends on the scale, and you start introducing the rotation. On very small scales, this thing goes bigger than one at some stage. So you can no longer talk about small fluctuations in the universe, which is more or less homogeneous. Things will start having their own dynamics. And eventually, what happens is things become very hot. Clusters are about 1,000,000 degrees. So things are really, really hot. So what happens is they start emitting X-rays, all kinds of crazy things. So it's not even photons at that level, it's a much higher level. And this will ionize the universe. So in this case, it's the opposite. It's actually the creation or the development through gravity of structures in the universe which are nonlinear that will cause the reionization of the universe. But we don't know what. We've never seen it. But this is still inside the dark ages. Maybe we will see it, we don't know yet.
Roughly
in years,
did recombination happen?
No, I don't know. It's basically, it's going to be, yeah, you have to convert. So A goes like, do you want me to do the calculation? So A is proportional to T to the 2/3 in matter. T is proportional to 1 over A. I have the ratio of the temperature, so I have the ratio of the T. If you want to do the calculation, that's how you do it. Top of my head, I don't know. Anything else? Okay, so let me move on. As I said, this is all going to be really, really qualitative, so ask questions, but don't ask questions which involve a calculation, because I will be doing that later, not now. Okay, so it's a... What I'll be doing now is more... So this is the physical, this is the Mickey Mouse physical process.
Okay.
And the next thing I'm going to be doing is actually experiments. I mean, what the hell happened? It made people become so crazy about the microwave background recently. So I'll be going through the experimentalist view. I'm really not going to be doing much more theory for the rest of this talk, for the rest of this lecture. I will leave that for the next one. So what happened is, it's actually a curious thing. When I was when I started my PhD, this was before this picture came along. You probably have seen it, the Kobe picture. So this is the 2006 Nobel Prize, half off anyway, Kobe DMR map. It was the first time we saw anisotropy fluctuations in the microwave background. And this is incredibly important. I remember when I started my PhD, you could literally say anything you wanted. And the papers got published, and when you could reject it, it was great. And then suddenly this picture came up, and the theory started to roll down and be ruled out, and a process which has been going on until today. For example, my PhD thesis has not been proved wrong. Is great, and it was proved wrong by experiment, and I think that's a good thing. So before 91, I would say that cosmology was a bit like string theory or gravity, quantum gravity. It was essentially a field which was driven by taste, by, if you want, by mathematics, but not by experiment. And this was the big, crucial level. Okay, at this point, Kobe map really changed completely everything in the perspective in cosmology. If you want, it turned cosmology into an experimental science, or an observational science. So I think it's quite fair, these guys got the Nobel Prize. Let me just tell you what essentially has been happening. His view is extremely biased towards satellites, because I think they're cool things, they put them in orbit. There's a lot of observations done from the ground, so I think they're fair here. There's actually quite a lot of things in between, I'm going to say. But the Kobe satellite in 92 or 91, 94 was really the beginning of this area, this field. So what happened is basically this thing, if you want to know, orbited the Earth. This might seem like an innocuous thing, it isn't, because there's a lot of systematic errors. There's a magnetic field which affects the way these things perform. It really is not the best place to do this observation. So first problem, it orbited the Earth. Second thing, the resolution was about 7 degrees. So this is actually smoothed on a scale which is not very small. So the resolution, the angular resolution, wasn't really. So what's been going on since then, and as I say, I'm really, really like being so unfair to a lot of people, it's a lot of work in Antarctica, all kinds of places, but what's been going on since then is an attempt to put more satellites in orbit, and you probably have heard about WMAP. So that's what cosmology is about now, these days, the WMAP. This thing was put in L2, Lagrange point L2. There's all these stationary points in the solar system. So if you put this, like a geostationary point, but with respect to the sun and the Earth going around, there's 5 of these points. There's one which is away from the Earth, in the middle of nowhere. It's perfect. It's perfect because, again, you basically don't have the sun. You don't have effects from the Earth. It's exactly the right place to do these kind of observations. So quite a lot of problems there have been solved. This is a WMAP temperature map. More obviously, the resolution has improved enormously. And well, depends on how you quote this, but basically you're talking about the resolution of 0.5 degree.
How do you define your resolution?
I will be defining it. But the problem is there's not one resolution, there's like 7 or 8 resolutions. And depending on how you combine these different observations, different frequencies, you get a different resolution. So this could be 0.25 degree. I'm being a bit loose about this. I will be defining it in a bit. Okay. So essentially, I'm just giving you the buzzwords, and then I'll go through this in more detail. This thing is sometimes called resolution or beam. So the beam is essentially, the map you get is the convolution of what is up there and the beam, which essentially gives you your angular sensitivity. And you're convolving the picture which is out there in the sky with your beam. So you're smoothing things because you're convolving them with the beam. So what I will be doing throughout this lecture is, you know, telling you the reason why do we want to do this. And is it just to get the prettier map? No, there is a scientific reason why high resolution is better. High resolution means a lot more physics, means a lot more theories thrown into the garbage bin. So that's the reason why we want higher resolution. It's not out of a skeptical interest. It's something which is very important. So that question about how do you define the resolution, well, it's the various. So one thing you'll hear sometimes is the frequency range. So there's the frequency channels. So that's something. None of these observations are done on different frequencies. For example, the Copio is done on three frequencies. WMAP has different frequency channels. Why? I'll be explaining in a bit. And something else, frequency coverage is important. And something else you may have heard is, for example, why is there a press release for WMAP 3 instead of WMAP 1? So why is it like first year release, second, third year release? In COVID, it was first, second, and 4 year releases. Is the microwave background changing from year to year? Well, it isn't. It's changing from billion years to billion years, but it's not changing on that scale. What changes is the noise. So every time you have more observations, you bring down the noise. So when you say WMAP 3, everyone is very excited about WMAP 3 as opposed to WMAP 1, talking about the noise mainly. So this whole thing about, so the main buzzwords you need to hear are resolution, frequency coverage, and number of years of observations. Why? This thing is about the noise. I'll be making a very simple model for this. But basically, if you look at one given pixel, the sigma square of the noise is a constant, which depends on your detector, divided by the time you spend observing that pixel. So the more time you spend observing that pixel, the better it is. If we have like a million pixels and you've been looking all over the sky, it takes 3 years to improve things by a significant factor, by a factor of three, square root of three. So all this excitement, first year, third year, is bringing down the noise. Why these different frequencies? Well, things are not as clean as we'd like them to be. I'm afraid that is the problem. So for example, this is what actually comes out of the COVID satellite. The first thing you see is very homogeneous thing with about 2.7 Kelvin. Then there's a dipole, which you can see is about millikelvin. The dipole is the result of our motion with respect to the cosmological frame. So that makes things hotter in the direction I'm moving and colder in the opposite direction. And then at the microkelvin level, so we're talking about 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 6, you finally find these fluctuations. And just when you thought you're in business, unfortunately, you find this terrible thing. We're inside the galaxy, and you cannot remove the galaxy. I can go to L2, I cannot get out of the galaxy to get rid of this big obstruction in doing a full scan map. So the reason for all this frequency coverage and all that is what we call the foregrounds. So the reason for all of these is galactic foregrounds. So more time, why more time? Less noise. Why more frequency channels? Because of the galactic foreground. And specifically, what is going on there? Well, specifically what happens is that we have the galaxy in the middle that's really unpleasant. We have to live with it. But it's not all lost because the microwave background is fermal. It's a Planck spectrum. Unfortunately, all these galactic emissions don't have a Planck spectrum. So by looking at different frequencies, I will be able to distinguish between what is the microwave background and what is everything else. So one thing you find is that, to be more specific, there's really three different foregrounds. There's galactic dust, there's synchrotron emission, there's free-free emission. This is a log log plot. So this thing is actually the microwave background as a Planck formula. So we have them. Essentially, what you find is, if you look at intensity as a function of the frequency, you get like Q, some kind of energy associated with mu, divided by T minus 1, so the Planck formula. And then two things which are pretty good happen here. The first one is, as I said, you have power law dependencies on frequency for the other emissions, and then you have a window around here, which is all the observations are going around 90 gigahertz for this reason. Around these 90 gigahertz, at least away from the galactic plane, you're completely dominated by the microwave background. So a big question mark has always been, could there be galactic emissions which are thermal? That would be a killer, okay? If someone, an astrophysicist, goes out there and finds some astrophysical process inside our galaxy that emits thermal radiation, you're really screwed completely. So it's quite a serious thing. You'll never be able to distinguish what is microwave background, what is galactic. But as long as we have a picture like this, all you need to do is do observations in as many frequencies as you can, and then see what is consistent with the thermal spectrum, what is not consistent with the thermal spectrum.
Why is the saturation in the CMT? Is it the
saturation as in what?
I mean not saturation, I mean like curving.
Oh, it's the Planck form. So the Planck formula, you probably see it differently. I mean, the Planck formula normally is quoted in terms of number of number of photons per given energy. So this thing is like, is this, it's a curve like this, with a peak, which is roughly of an energy, which depends on the temperature. What people actually compute is the intensity. So you have to integrate these. So it's you probably know this. I mean, it's essentially d square. This is the phase space pattern. And you have an E. And then you have a point form. So it's this quantity really that's actually measured when you make a plot. They call this the antenna temperature. It's really weird. I don't know what an antenna temperature is, but it's basically that quantity times the factor which is like efficiency of the antenna. Okay, it's actually easier than this. Let me just show you a few more pictures. For example, the synchrotron foreground has this funny kind of, you can actually, one thing you can do, this is the other option you can do, you can actually look at frequencies in which a given foreground dominates. And then you make a map, then you make an extrapolation to the frequencies in which you're observing the microwave background in this traffic. So they have two techniques. One is look at different frequencies and find a linear combination that takes away the thermal one, the thermal component. The other one is actually monitor what these foregrounds are doing as a function of the sky at the frequency in which they dominate and then subtract it. So this is what people do, and this is why there's so much interest in foregrounds and all that. The very important thing here, I should say this straight away, which is a big tragedy, the synchrotron is completely polarized. And this is the reason why we're going to have very serious problems playing this game to polarization map. So I'll be mentioning this later on in the last lecture. I'll go over polarization, what can we learn from polarization. But the big, big killer is this guy here, the synchrotron. I couldn't care less about the astrophysical process. As far as a cosmologist is concerned, this is all junk. But this junk that will have a very serious effect. So the big thing I told earlier on, we may detect gravity waves in polarization. I'll tell you why. May run against this obstacle here. This thing may cause a foreground that completely obscures any intrinsic polarization that might be out there. So this came as a shock. The big thing about Public Map 3 was the revelation that the polarization of the foregrounds is actually much higher than what we hoped, or at least we thought it would be. So the other ones, well, there you are, pretty picture, but nothing special. This is the free, this is all kinds of things. I actually forgot to put the dust in here. But eventually, playing these games, you end up with a map such as this one. So there's a lot of processing here, and you should know about that. And there will be question marks about systematics, about foregrounds, about noise, all kinds of things, which essentially are in between the cosmology and the observations, and they're unavoidable. Okay, so let me tell you about the third thing, which I didn't mention there. So this is where we are. COBE was the big turning point in cosmology. WMAP is where we are at the moment. The Planck satellite is the next big thing. We hope we will get polarization maps to a level where we may be able to find gravity waves. So the Planck satellite, just to mention what it is, it's essentially something that might fly, might go to L2, just like WMAP. It's not yet clear when or exactly what way this is going to happen. The resolution is really much higher, and yet again, it's not because we're making a nicer map more aesthetic. There's a lot of physics coming out of it. Talking about 10 arcmeters. So the question you ask, what is the resolution? What happens is basically each different frequency channel has a different resolution. So it depends on how you combine them to make a map. So the resolution is always something that depends on the process which you use to subtract the foregrounds, combining the different frequencies. But let's say 10 arcminutes as opposed to half a degree, I think it's not a big improvement, it will make a big difference. And above all, you will have many more frequency channels. So lots of frequency channels. Why do we want more frequency channels? Yet again, it's not because I want to make it more complicated. Experiment is because I want to make sure I can subtract the foregrounds better. And what Planck is going to try and do is polarization properly. So we better have very good templates for these foregrounds, different frequencies. We better have many more frequencies. Combine them and see which bit is fermal, which is not. So I wasn't going to mention this, but it is a political statement. Okay, but there's actually two different ways of doing in frequency of doing observation. So there's about 100 gigahertz, let's say, which is like a dividing line, and then you use different technologies, actually. So you use bolometers at very high frequencies. And you use radio receivers, something called HENTS, at low frequencies. So quite a lot of the stuff has been done with HENTS so far. The idea of putting bolometers and having basically complementary pictures is what Planck is going to be doing, which is so crucial. We have two instruments aboard of Planck. There's a low frequency instrument and a high frequency instrument. So quite a lot of stuff in the low frequency instrument is going to be monitoring the synchrotron. And quite a lot of stuff is not even microwave background in the high frequency is going to be monitoring dust. And then in between, you actually have an area in which we have ends of bolometers, which is actually looking at the microwave background. So I hope they agree, and in case you're acquainted with European politics, there's always a big problem here. So the French produced one and the Italians produced the other. If they don't agree, there's going to be a big war. It's not going to be pleasant. If they don't agree, most likely the problem is the foreground model we're using. Because it's, there could be an experimental problem as well in terms of the instrument. So barring some French-Italian war, what is going to come out of Planck is a very high resolution map in which we know what the foregrounds are doing very well. We have subtracted it very well. That's a bit of an overkill for the temperature, but it might be crucial for the polarization. And there's even people saying Planck isn't good enough. We should have a polarization satellite in orbit. So there are people already talking about in 20 years or 10 years' time having a satellite in orbit just to measure things even better with more frequency channels to make sure the polarization is really pinned down properly. Okay, any questions about this? This is the hardware. I know you're all theorists, so this is a bit of a shock. But anyway, I should have to give it to you. I'm going to move on to the software. This is a good point to ask questions if you want. Okay. So let me tell you a bit about the software now. So I'm not yet going to do any theory, kind of very deep theory, but I'm going to be telling you about how we look at these things, these maps, and how we extract information from these maps, which can then be fed into cosmologists, into theorists. It's something which really goes through different levels. It's very important to make this statement here. What you make with these maps is essentially a matter of your prejudice. If you're very prejudiced, you can throw away a lot of information, and you come up with just five numbers. If you're not very prejudiced, you keep every single pixel, okay? And then it's a nightmare because there's too much information. So at some point, you need to be somewhere in between. But there really are three, four different levels at which you can look at these maps. And I'm going to be telling you this because it's important when I go into issues like resolution. Why do we need more resolution? As I said, it's not an aesthetic thing. There's a good reason. There's good scientific reasons for that. So the basic thing is, well, every time you have a map like this, what do you do with it? And as I said, the different levels at which can look at these. So the first one is actually whether this thing is a Gaussian process or not.
Levels.
There's going to be a zeroth level, which I'll mention in a bit. Because really, no one really goes to this level. But the first level is one I just showed you, is the map. So I make a map and I keep a map, and every time I have a theory, I can compare the theory with the map. That's one thing I could do, okay? But if the theory is a Gaussian theory, then the second level is the power spectrum. And yet again, I'll explain as we go along, what is a CL? Why is it? This is basically the spherical version of the Fourier transform, or the variance Fourier transform. The power spectrum is normally the meeting point between theory and observation. And the reason is, if I assume that the theory is Gaussian, the only thing that really is predicted is the power spectrum. So I should say here, Gaussian and isotropic. Sometimes people forget this, but if I assume that statistically I have an isotropic process, then the power spectrum contains all the information in the map. So level one goes to level two. When you throw away this picture, you say this is just for the press release, it's a beautiful picture, but what scientists really want to see is this picture. And throughout this lecture, I'll explain what is this L, what is this, why I put an L times L plus one there, what's the reason for that, what's the Michael Kelvin square doing there, what are these various peaks, why is this curve, what I predict in a theory, graphic that I observe, what are these error bars, which are these bands, what's these error bars, which are these lines. I'll be explaining all of these, which is the thing people are flashing all the time when they want to get money to make a plan for this observation. Okay. So I'll be telling the theoretical reason behind wanting to reduce these error bars, why we cannot reduce some of the others, but I'll be explaining the terminology completely into this picture. There's a third level, and that's probably more related to the previous lecture you had here. Once you have this thing, once you have a picture like with the power spectrum, I may end up with a list of cosmological parameters. And I will be explaining what all these various parameters are. But level number three is what sometimes is called cosmoparameters. And I can throw away even that picture, the picture with the power spectrum, if I have a theory which gives me the power spectrum as a function of model parameters. So suppose I have inflation, suppose I have pyrotic, suppose I have whatever, then I have a theory which predicts the CLs as a function of these parameters, and I can use this picture here into something that constrains these various parameters. And level zero, which is one of the most neglected levels, is essentially something no one actually likes to watch, to see. It's kind of a time-ordered series. I might as well tell you this. What actually comes out of an observation is like a huge file telling you exactly in each time where you were looking and what you were observing. And then you have to make a map out of it. And normally, going from here to here means relying on the graduate student who did this. And I hope there's no mistakes there, because I do not want to look at time-ordered series myself. Okay? So this thing means a lot of work. It's important to say that there's a lot of systematic errors inside the solar system all over the place, which really is hidden going from level zero to level one. But here, I'm going to start from the map. I'm going to be telling from the map, how do I get the power spectrum? How do I get the cosmological parameters? Okay, so let me tell you what these various things are. Mainly, I'm going to be talking about various strange nomenclature things that people use. Why do we want more resolution? That's going to be related to going deep into this regime here. Why do I want to detect these extra peaks? It's because I want to kill theories. It's because I want, even if not kill theories, to actually learn more about the parameters of the theories which have not been killed. So let me tell you a bit about the production of power spectrum, and then we'll move on into the more complex things. Okay, so what is the angular power spectrum? This is really something that derives directly from the Fourier transform on a sphere. So there's this thing called the spherical harmonics, YLM, that are a function of solid angle, and which generalize the Fourier transform on a plane. So it's essentially a way of doing Fourier transform if you confine to the sphere, the orthonormal functions in the sense that if you integrate them over the sphere, the complex, you basically get delta L, L prime, delta M, M prime. So this is a definition of spherical harmonic. It's not very, very useful until, well, I could put the pictures there, or I could write the formula there, but instead let me show you a few of these things. You end up, basically, if you have any temperature map, delta T, what you do is, so this thing has units of microkelvin. Let me start by telling you the units, but this is confusing. What you do is, you want to expand these in L and M. You get a series of ALMs, which are the coefficients, the equivalent of the Fourier coefficients, times YLM. And because of this orthonormality relation, basically, if I want the ALMs, I just need to integrate over the sphere. So I have a temperature map, and what I do is I convolve it with a complex conjugate of LM. I integrate over the sphere, and I get the ALM coefficients. So this is really going to Fourier space. And let me give you some feeling of what these things are. Basically, the M tells you about shapes. The L tells you about the angular scale which you're looking at. So for example, there's one thing you can actually see immediately here. You can roughly convert the L, which appears in the power spectrum, with the angular scale. And bigger L means bigger wave number, means smaller wavelength, means an angular scale that's smaller. So half a degree, which was the angular scale of map, the blue map is around here. 10.5 minutes is going to be somewhere around there. Planck is more complicated than that. You can actually go a bit further in, but I'll explain in a minute. But essentially, if you look at the given ALM, the given YLM, if you change the L, and you have, for example, M equals zero, you change the number of bands you have, you change the angular scale, but for example, for M equals zero, we always have Jupiter modes. So these things which have bands, latitude bands, and no variations. In longitude, if you look at the other modes, for example, the M equals L modes, it's the opposite. You have lots of bands. You increase the L, you basically have an angular scale that gets smaller and smaller, but you have the same kind of shapes. And in between them, you actually have things which divide the sphere in bands and in longitude zones. So you have a combination of both. But invariably, the L relates to the angular scale of these shapes. And the M tells you what kind of shapes you're looking at. So this gets progressively more and more complicated, but if you have a bit of experience, you can actually, by looking at the picture like this, I can tell you what the L and the M is. But the good kind of picture is, and this varies sometimes, depends on what you look at, but roughly the L goes like an angle, which depends on what quantity you're looking at. It could be 60 degrees, could be 120 degrees. But the important thing is that you have the angular scale there. So the higher the L, the smaller the angular scale. So high resolution means penetrating into the L, into the power spectrum, beyond the given L. So this is the picture, the overall picture of going to Fourier space on a sphere. But the thing is, I'm never actually Yeah, there will never have a theory telling you the ALMs are about to be a given value. So for this simple reason that whenever I have a map like this, which I observe, and we find your map here, any theory, be it inflation, be it whatever it is never going to tell you it's going to be a cold bit there and a hot bit there, whatever. What you do is you find statistical predictions. You say, if I have an ensemble of universes, I can define statistical predictions for this ensemble of which this guy is one example. Or if I'm ergodic, I can go from horizon to horizon, say that all these things are independent, and I can define statistical properties for these different horizons of the same universe. But I can never predict that one we have, this thing is going to be hot and this one is going to be cold. So any theory will predict delta t, will predict ALMs as random variables, as stochastic variables. And what I will be predicting is really statistical properties for these things. Never that actually I have a deterministic prediction for this map. Okay? This is very important because people compute averages and so on. And sometimes people ask, why do you compute an average? Why don't you just compute specifically what you find there? It would be great if I had a theory that told me what was in the middle that caused all these fluctuations, what was there specifically, but I never have that. I just have something that predicts ensemble average over this ensemble of universes or of horizon volumes. I hope this is clear, because otherwise I'm going to be in trouble for the rest of the lecture. So these guys here are random variables in any theory. And the random variables over an ensemble of universes or over an ensemble of skies of which what we see is an example, is an element. Okay, so if the theory is Gaussian, what does that mean? Well, it means essentially that the ALM is Gaussian. And if you have something which is a Gaussian variable, you know that it is fully determined by the average and by the variance. So specifically, well, in this case, because the average temperature, the whole thing as well, this is very easy to prove, by the way, it's your exercise. It has to be zero. If I define the T naught in defining delta T properly, this has to be zero by definition. So the only thing I need to know is a covariance matrix. In which this average is the average I've just mentioned, but I spent 5 minutes telling you this. You didn't complain about it, so there you go, that's what that average means. So the covariance matrix in this case, if I have isotropy, which was one thing I stressed over there, if I have isotropy, then this covariance matrix has got to be diagonal. It's an exercise for the student as well. If you're mathematically oriented, this goes back to Schur's lemma, so because basically the ALMs are irreducible representations of the rotational group. So basically anything like this would have to be diagonal. And of course, there could be a number there, which depends on L, and that's the CL. So this is the definition of CL. This is called the angular power spectrum. So yet again, the form of this covariance matrix is determined by an isotropy. The only thing which isn't determined is this function called the angular power spectrum, C sub L, which is what everyone has been trying to predict in every theory and what every observational CMB person is trying to measure. So this is really the meeting ground between theory and observation, if you assume Gaussian. So the rest doesn't really matter, because if you have a Gaussian, of course, as you know, the cumulants of the distribution are zero. So everything else is really determined. In other words, the odd momentum are all zero, and even order momentum can all be written in terms of the power spectrum using Vick's theorem. So if I have the C sub L and I have a Gaussian theory, this is the end of the story. It's not that the other higher order moments are zero, but the code can always be determined in terms of the second order momentum. Okay, next, what happens now? Well, what happens is that essentially, we only have one sky. It's a big tragedy. I mean, I would love to have 1,000 skies, but there's only one. And this is really the thing that causes all the problems. And this explains part of the error bars I gave you before. You probably saw that band. I'm going to be explaining now is this band. There's this gray band here. What is this gray band? This gray band is an error bar I can never remove because it's the result of the fact that I only have one sky. And there will always be an uncertainty comparing theory and observation because of it. So if I predict a theory which gives me this CL line, the observed CL will always be falling within this band for this reason. And this is something which is called cosmic variance, which I'm going to compute now. Cosmic variance is an irremovable error bar that results from the fact I make observations about an ensemble of universes but I only have one, or about an ensemble of horizons but I only have one horizon. So if you had a wormhole that pumped you into some other horizon and you could see the sky out there, I could reduce the cosmic variance. But it's the only way to reduce the cosmic variance. So there's a thing called cosmic variance, and you just mentioned this. Which results from the fact that these ALMs are come from one sky, and I must estimate the CL out of the ALMs I have just in one sky. So what people do to try and beat cosmic variance as much as they can is notice that for a given L, actually, I have different M's. I have two L plus one M's. So what you do is you average over these guys the ALM in the sky. And this is the best you can do. You can actually prove this is the best estimator I can find. So this CL with a hat means the estimator I can produce from the sky, estimator of this property, which I can compute from the theory. So the whole game of comparing observations and theory is going to be comparing these two things. Which is exactly what you see in here. These are estimates, not quite done in this way, but I'll explain how they produce later on, but that's a very kind of Mickey Mouse version of what they are. So comparing those two is really the game between comparing theory and observations. So what is the cosmic variance? This is really the clue for why the hell do I want high resolution maps? Because I want to beat cosmic variance. You can see it decreasing as I go further up in L. That is really the reason why I'm doing all these high resolution maps. So let me compute. Well, first of all, a very important thing is this is true, otherwise it would not be an estimator. This is why you sometimes call these things a minor estimator. So the average of your estimator has better be the parameter you're trying to estimate. So this is obviously true. You can compute it trivially from there. But then when you compute the sigma square of the CL, well, this thing is 1 over 2L plus 1 square sum over M sigma square ALM square. And now you compute this quantity. How do you do this? Well, the best way is to break this into 2L plus 1 real modes. So these things are complex, but they can be written as real modes if you want. And then use this fact that if you add up a quantity which has zero average and sigma square variance, and if this thing is a Gaussian, then the fourth moment is 3 times sigma to the fourth. So the variance in sigma square, if you have a Gaussian quantity, is actually twice x sigma to the fourth. And sigma here is actually the variance of this guy, of the ALM, which is the CL. So this thing becomes equal to, here I'm going to go here, becomes 2L plus 1 terms divided by 2L plus 1 square times twice CL. Let me just write the result in here. Sigma square of CL equals 2 divided by 2L plus 1 CL squared. And the crucial point is that for high L, if I compute now sigma CL, so this is the fractional uncertainty, this thing goes like 1 over square root of L. So if I want to beat this issue of cosmic variance, what I need to do is go to higher and higher resolution, which means higher and higher L. And this is the reason why doing these maps progressively more and more expensive, and that look better and better. But it's not because they're looking better that we're doing the exercise, mm-hmm. because we want to beat cosmic variance.
Beating the cosmic variance for higher delts. I mean, for lower values,
you can't do. I mean, the cosmic variance would be smaller and smaller for higher L.
Yes.
So if I have a theory, I make a prediction for CL over all the Ls, okay?
Yeah.
So for example, this red line is a prediction from a given theory. So I want to test this theory. I have to go to higher Ls, because otherwise I have this. If I just make a test this theory there,
yes.
suppose I could have a theory that went like this. They would be confused with this theory because of cosmic variance. So there was a time when people mentioned this by the name of cosmic confusion. You want to reduce cosmic confusion. Okay, that's what you're doing. Cosmic confusion is the confusion between different theories that arises from cosmic variance. And you beat that by going to higher levels.
But you will never be able to improve what happens at smaller levels.
No. So if I have two theories which are different, this is very relevant. Later on, this is going to be crucial. If I have two theories that only differ in terms of smaller L, then that's it. Except that I didn't mention one important thing here, which is polarization. It's not enough as far as it's all temperature. Polarization provides another way to remove these degeneracies separately. Okay. Yeah.
So for L equals 400, say, you can only get something like a 10% off. If I use your estimate, I would get 10%. But a systematic error. But I don't quite see that from that. So
I should say, so there's two things. One is the systematic error and all that. That's a different matter. So these error bars here are going to be, this is observational error bars. It's not cosmic variance.
Yes.
But these things here, you're right. This looks wrong. If you use that formula, this looks wrong.
No, I'm saying it's slightly different thing. So if I just ask, what the cosmic variance for L to 100 meters from your estimate, it seems to be something like a 10%. But I don't quite see that from
Yes, so that's exactly what I was going to say. So you were beam. What you do to prevent that from happening, you actually beam. This is not L by L. In fact, I should have got a picture of L by L. So with L by L, you actually see it's varying. So this is a PR exercise, I should mention. What people do when they make a plot like this is they don't just give you one CL estimate, they actually beam them. So there's like a beam. Sometimes you put horizontal error bars to avoid this confusion here. You actually compute, for example, beam from 5 to 10, or from 15 to 20 or something. And if you do that, then you get the same result here, but of course you're summing over more elements in there, okay? So you beat the cosmic variance. So you're quite right, this picture looks wrong. It was clever, okay? That's not 10%. Why is it not 10%? Because it's not just one element. It's actually a bigger range of elements. If you actually made a picture, maybe I should have brought it. If you make a picture L by L, it's not as smooth as this one, but you actually see the 10% things you mentioned, these variations. Okay. Let me move on. So, forever I go. So I'm doing really to observe. I'm not an experimentalist, but I'm giving some kind of like experimental side of the story because I think it's important. And so where am I? Cosmic variance. So the problem is that this is, if there was no noise, if there wasn't a beam, if there was nothing else. So I'm just telling you, what is the reason for having resolution? Why do I need resolution even before I consider the experimental problems? And this is hurdle number one, cosmic bear. So I want to beat that, therefore I should go to higher momentum moments. Okay, let me move on and I'll tell you the really dirty bit about microwave black, which is the noise, the beam, and all these other things. Okay, so this was really, really assuming that what I look up there is exactly what is there. In fact, it isn't. There are all kinds of problems. And so there's a problem of, okay, again, I'm not going to be doing this in order. There's going to be a number one here, I'll in a minute. There's going to be a number two, which is the issues of beam or finite resolution. I'm going to be answering your question in part here. That's what is the beam. I'm going to give you a definition of the beam. Model is the fact that the beam is different for different frequencies, and I'm going to ignore that detail. And then there's the issue of noise. I never do an observation without experimental noise. So I'll be telling you what these error bars mean. Some of this is noise, some of this is beam. It's mainly a combination of both. And you know one of them already. It's basically cosmic variance. You know the microkelvin square there, you know what the L means. You still don't know what the L times L plus 1 means, that's going to be next lecture. But let me explain what these error bars actually mean. Well, in practice, one problem is I never have a smooth sphere, picture of the sphere, of course not. I have to pixelize the sphere. But let me mention this straight away. So the problem number one is that the ALMs are never those integrals. What they are is a sum over pixels of the area of the pixel, which is 4 pi solid angle divided by the number of pixels, the temperature, or the delta temperature in that pixel, and then the spherical harmonic in that pixel. It's important to introduce the concept of pixel, because without it, I cannot discuss the noise anyway. Because the noise depends on the size of the pixel, as I'll explain. But crucially, there's all kinds of systematic errors that could come around if I don't pixelize properly. So the question is, where is the middle of the pixel? Am I smoothing over the pixel? All of these things. The NASA, the whole of the NASA, and COBE in particular, at some point used something called quad cube. So every time they have to make a map with a satellite, they encircle the sky with a cube, they put a lattice on the cube, and they projected it on the sphere. It's the most stupid thing you can possibly do, okay? And you can see exactly why. The reason is you're going to get distortions along the edges of the corners of the sphere. Unfortunately, there is a theorem telling there's a topological obstruction. You cannot put a perfect regular lattice in the sphere. So we have to basically make do with the physics and the next best. And this is what people use at the moment, hill peaks. That's basically a way, hierarchical way, of pixelizing the sphere without distorting things overly, without distorting them too much. So I'll just mention this, but it's important. You can actually end up with all kinds of crazy anisotropic artifacts in your map if you introduce some pixelization scheme, which isn't good enough. But the idea is that whenever you do a calculation, you should use a pixelization refinement that has pixels much smaller than the angular scales that you're interested in. So for a given ALM, I know what the angular scale is corresponding to L. I should use a pixel which is much, much smaller. I should oversample, in other words. So this is the first kind of hurdle into getting things done properly. It's important also for what I'm going to discuss later, which is the noise. And the problem is that this guy here, delta T of pixel, is to begin with, is the actual temperature, or delta T in the sky. First of all, convolved with the beam, which is the beam of sensitivity corresponding to my measurement. And then in addition, I have a noise term in a given pixel. So first of all, these integrals, actually it's not there anymore. So these integrals which lead to ALM are not integrals, they're sums over pixels with a refinement which should be sufficient for a given L. And then in addition, I have to be very careful because what I'm actually catching in the pixel is to begin with the smoothing, the real map, and then the noise which falls in that pixel. Okay, so what is the beam? The beam is basically a given B of theta. So the beam in general is something which is as immutably symmetric and which is Gaussian. And it has a sigma, or actually what I gave you before is not a sigma, is the full width at max corresponding to that sigma. So that's what it is quoted when I say 7 degrees or half a degree or whatever. But if I want to know the effect of smoothing by a beam with something like that, what I need to do is find the spherical harmonic expansion of this guy. And if I have a Gaussian with a theta, which is much smaller, or a sigma, which is much smaller than 4 pi, 7 degrees, even 7 degrees is much smaller than 4 pi, I can find that when I do the expansion of B into BLM, I basically only have the BL, because this thing is as immutably symmetric, so I only get Jupiter in those YLMs I showed you. And I can actually show that this thing is e to the minus L squared sigma squared divided by 2. So this is the beam. So that very kind of simplistic definition of the beam, in general, is much more complicated. But using the convolution theorem, now I can actually say what the LMs are going to be like, because if something is a convolution in real space, then the Fourier transform simply multiplied. And the same thing happens. You can prove an exactly the same kind of theorem using spherical harmonics. So what you find is that ALM observed is at this level ALM sky times B of L. And, well, in principle, this wouldn't be a problem. So this is actually a very counterintuitive thing. But basically what would happen is that the measured power spectrum would be exponentially suppressed as you hit the beam. So if you go through this, you observe CLs. If you now compute the CLs, this guy on average will be your average CL times e to the minus L squared sigma squared because I have this extra factor multiplying the LMs. What is counterintuitive here is that I know the beam very well. So if it wasn't for the noise, I could deconvolve the thing perfectly. So this is a well-known fact in image processing. Okay, if you find something that's really blurred, but I know how the thing was blurred, and I have no noise, I can just divide whatever I'm observing by the beam, and I get the thing which was out there in the first place. So I can sharpen up pictures very well, as long as there's no noise. So what you need to do here, so deconvolving the beam, what you need to do here is basically take your estimator CL and send this to something which essentially divides by the beam. If you define another estimator by this result, then you say this is CL and bias now. Then you know that the CL and bias would be CL. And the thing which is a bit strange here is that actually exercise for the student. I'm going to be doing this in more generality, but here we could already do the calculation. The cosmic variance is the same. So you did not increase the uncertainty at this level because we have the beam. Very counterintuitive, but it's the way, it's a well-known fact in image processing. If I blur things, there's no noise, and I know how I blur them, I can always recover the raw result by deconvolving the beam. The problem is the noise. So the noise is the thing that screws up everything. So whenever I go here, and I end up into this old issue of, you know, going into the beam and so on, the problem is combination of the noise and the beam. It's never just the beam, it's a combination of noise. Which is the reason why WMAP3 was more important for this picture. So at some point, people were wondering, what happens to the third peak? Is there a third peak or not? To do that, you have to dig into the beam by lowering the noise, going from WMAP1 to WMAP3. Let me show you that I'll actually be doing the calculation now. So the problem with the noise is that sigma square noise is a Brownian process, so it's going to be some sensitivity of your instrument divided by the time spent on the peaks. So clearly the time spent on a pixel, because all I'm doing is I have a satellite there that is going around, is rotating, doing all kinds of things. If I make the pixel smaller, I spend more time on each pixel. So the time on a given pixel is actually proportional to only a pixel. If I make the pixels bigger, I reduce the noise. Then I get a coarser approximation as well. So the quantity which is normally qualifies a given map is actually these. W minus 1 is like the inverse weight of a given map in terms of the noise, is sigma square noise times omega pixel. So this does not depend on the level of pixelization, because if I make the pixel smaller or bigger, the noise changes, but that quantity does not change. That quantity changes if I go from 1 year of observations to 3 years of observations, but not from pixelization level to level. Okay, so let me compute this now. So what you need to do now is compute specifically what is the correlation matrix of ALNs as observed. So remember that the ALNs are now a combination of the sky convolved with the beam and the noise. So it's several things. The ALNs are going to be ALN sky times the BL, as before. This is just a convolution theorem. And now we need to find the ALN for the noise. So if I want the ALN for the noise, then so the noise doesn't correlate with the sky, I hope anyway. But that would be quite a tragic thing if there was a correlation between the noise and the CMB. So I can compute this separately because it decouples when I compute the correlation matrix. So ALM noise, ALM star. Well, this thing is going to be sum over, so I use those approximations, sums over pixels. So I get sum over P and P prime. Then I get omega pixel square, because I get an omega pixel per ALM. Then I get YLM of P, YL prime M prime of P prime. This guy is complex conjugate. And then I get T, P, and T, P prime noise. I call these guys, I think I call these guys noise. Let me copy them. And this is a slightly different ensemble average, but I couldn't care less. But basically, this is an ensemble over different observations, different experiments. So the noise itself is a stochastic variable, of course. And this thing now is what is sigma squared noise. Delta P in P prime. So I use this expression here. So I replace the sigma square in terms of W minus 1 omega P. And basically, this delta here collapses this guy, this sum. And I end up with sum over P omega pixel square, sigma square n, and then these two guys. And now this is simply W minus 1, delta LL prime, delta MN prime. So I use the omega square, so I use omega sigma square to get this guy, the W minus 1. And I need an omega here to convert this sum into an integral. And by using that integral, then I can use the orthonormality of the spherical harmonics to get this delta. So the crucial result is actually here. I'm going to write it here. What you get is So you get delta L, L prime, delta N, N prime. Then you get CL, BL squared, plus W minus 1. I'm running out of time, so I'm just going to quote the answer at this point. Final result. So the trick I want to do now is, given that I have this result, I want to find an estimator which is actually centered. So I need to divide my CL hat by the right amount of BL and subtract this is the noise bias, this is the B. So the exercise now is find another estimator from the original one, which gives me center of the CL. And then what is the variance? That is the question. So that's the exercise I need to do. I'll be doing it explicitly, but let me just quote the answer. So I take my CL hat, which is really not the right one, and what I should do is basically find a CL and bias, just like before, which I can show in this case is my original CL, you subtract the W minus 1, and you divide by the mean squared. So this you can prove now using that expression there, and I can prove that this guy now indeed as an average CL, which is why I call it unbiased. But when I compute sigma square of this guy, well, I get 2 divided by 2L plus 1. That's good. Then I get the CL.
Hello?
Then I get W minus 1 e to the L square sigma square. So this is the formula. It's actually not very difficult, but anyway, I was going to do this explicitly, but anyway, got the answer here. So one thing you notice is exactly what I said before, that you could already prove. If the noise is zero, the uncertainty does not increase with respect to the cosmic variance. Okay? All you need to do is deconvolve the beam, which is what I did when I discussed the beam. It's the combination of the noise and the beam that are really a killer. So what you see here is that the sigma square is going to blow up exponentially. We have e to the L square sigma square there. So the noise, the effect of the noise becomes massive very quickly. But it's because of the noise as well, because of this W minus 1. So the thing which was absolutely crucial in going from W map 1 to W map 3 was not so much the beam was of course half a degree all the time, but it was the noise going down, which allowed you to be mining into the beam a bit, and as a result you could recover the third peak, which was very important. And as a result, a couple of theories went down the drain, which was good. Okay, I'll stop here. I promise to be a bit more theoretically oriented in the next lecture. At least I gave you a feeling of what these various things in this plot.